Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome back, everybody. Well, it never rains, but it pours. And in my case today, I never get to interview anybody about portal hypertension, ever, ever, ever. But today, I'm interviewing two people. A surprise for me, and I hope that I can handle the stress. Or maybe the best thing to do is just to make certain that it's the interviewees and not me who gets stressed. In that event, let me introduce you to the two people who have come today to be part of this conversation. There's Tasos Chromatokopoulos, whom I worked with until, I think, 10 years ago that I left King's College Hospital in London, where you were climbing through the ranks. You became a consultant shortly after I left, if I remember correctly.
That is correct, Alex.
And what rank do you occupy now?
The same consultant rank, you know, in the NHS, the rank remains as a consultant.
I would have thought you'd at least have earned a gold star by now. And from Le Kremlin des Etres in Paris, the Juanes Ackermann. And I want to point out that her forename, O-A-N-E-Z, is a cognate of the more usual Agnes, Juanes, and that she is from Breton stock, from Brittany. Now, tell me how you made your way from Carignan to Paris.
In fact, I was born near Paris.
Oh,
sorry to disappoint you.
She's a pseudo-Breton. I had no idea. But at least she has a Breton forename. Now, you are at Le Kremlin Bicêtre. Where did you do your pediatric training?
In the area of Paris.
All of the regional Paris hospitals. Yeah. I'm sure you would have been at Necker, you would have been at Robert Debré.
Exactly.
And how did it happen that you settled at Le Kremlin?
It's a love story.
A love story?
with the unit and the people who are working there.
Fantastic. But now we have the question of how did you happen to make your home turf portal hypertension? How did that happen to become your specialty, your area of expertise?
Well, it's because my interest for endoscopy was very high.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a training 1 year with a gastroenterologist.
The adult gastroenterologist?
No, pediatrician.
That's the time you spent out at Debré.
Yes.
Okay.
And then it grows up and
things just fall into place and here we are. Okay, understood. How about you, sir?
Well, I was involved in the first and few clinical trials in children in portal hypertension at King's College Hospital. And that gave me a taste of the service and the gaps that there were there in the management of portal hypertension in children, and gave me the incentive to take this field forward and try to advance it and try to make some progress in terms of how we manage these patients.
You've recommended this pair of portal hypertension specialists have recommended for our attention three articles. And if you go to the note that accompanies on the website this particular podcast, you'll be able to see the references that they gave us. But let me start with the first one, which is from Hepatology. It's titled Non-Invasive Liver Disease Assessment to Identify Portal Hypertension, Systematic and Narrative Reviews Supporting the AASLD Practice Guideline. What relevance does this study carried out in adults have to pediatric hepatologists?
Thank you, Alex. Well, I think this is where the key point is. As you may know already, the review was initially inclusive in adults and pediatrics.
I had no idea. No, really? Okay.
Yes. It was one of the PICO questions to identify, you know, similar evidence for pediatrics. But unfortunately, the authors and the librarians probably who were involved in the process failed to find any evidence for children on the field.
This is a summary of summaries, really. A collection of previous work in an attempt to derive principles, a meta-analysis, would you call it?
Yes.
Okay. And you're not telling me that there was no published work in pediatric portal hypertension?
No, there is work published, but there isn't strong enough evidence published out there to show that, you know, we can very vigorously come up with guidelines that will shape up how we manage children with portal hypertension.
That's the gap you're talking about, huh? So how do we explain the lack of a pediatric study that meets those inclusion criteria? You've been at this, well, I left King's at 10 years ago, and you started to explore portal hypertension 15 years ago?
That's correct.
Have you been sleeping on the job? Why didn't you compile such a study?
Because there are significant limitations, you know, in doing this kind of studies in children. The first, the paradigm that the adults use is measuring hepatic venous pressure gradient, which is a very invasive procedure. It is costly, it's time consuming, and also has a lot of risks and requires a certain skill set that not all centers have in the pediatric liver world. So this was one of the major limitations for this review paper to include children. But at the same time, you know, you saw how much they limited down the number of eligible papers for adults as well. From 9,000, they went down to 10 papers, 9 papers, I think, eventually.
They may be few, but they were fine.
Well, fine, we can say, but, you know, when you actually go in deeper into these papers, there's always limitations and there's always pitfalls there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No study can ever be perfect.
Ah, he's making excuses for himself again. One is, okay. Anyhow, so, but pediatrics, the diagnosis of portal hypertension certainly is assigned in pediatrics. And if that assignation is not being done on the basis of transhepatic pressure gradients, then other non-invasive markers must be used. What are those? Non-invasive markers of portal hypertension? What? Don't all answer at once. One is your turn.
So let's begin by clarifying what we are actually looking for when we talk about non-invasive markers in portal hypertension, especially in children. When following a child already known to have portal hypertension, the goal isn't just to confirm the diagnosis. It's to anticipate complications. And we are talking about events like gastrointestinal bleeding or size of decompensation. That includes ascites, encephalopathy, infections, or even acute kidney injury. But the main clinical questions remains, which child should we send for a screening endoscopy to look for esophageal varices?
And?
So we have some classic clinical markers, you know, like splenomegaly, visible collateral veins, ascites. That might sound basic, but they're still relevant, I think. In fact, in many cases now, they're the only reason an endoscopy is performed. So we shouldn't underestimate them.
So what's the most promising combination of these markers?
I think it would be a combination of imaging techniques and serum biomarkers.
And go on.
Well, thrombocytopenia and other signs of hyperplenism, like leukopenia or low factor V, can be helpful, but they're not always reliable, especially in children under 2, because hypersplenism often takes time to develop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the specific case of biliary atresia, which, as you know, is the leading cause of pediatric cirrhosis, we do have some red flags. Children under 1 year of age and those with a total bilirubin above 100 micromoles per liter had a higher risk of developing high-risk varices early on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Oh, how do you think things are going to evolve in the next 5 years or so?
Well, newer biomarkers are arising, biomarkers reflecting endothelial dysfunction, inflammation, fibrosis, and even metabolic imbalance inside the liver. And they're currently being explored, both in adults and in children. For example, the von Willebrand factor seems to rise in portal hypertension, likely due to changes into the sinusoidal endothelium. But as with many emerging tools, we need large multicenter studies in pediatrics before we can bring these into routine care.
But variceal bleeding isn't the only serious complication of portal hypertension. I can think of, for example, pulmonary hypertension. And how are we assessing, say, pulmonary hypertension in children with portal hypertension? And you've given us to consider prevalence and predictors of pulmonary hypertension in children with portal hypertension, a single center study by Elkofi and all. And I'd like your thoughts on the issues that this article raises.
Yeah, I think the issue this article raises mostly is the high prevalence of portal pulmonary hypertension.
Almost 30%.
Almost 30%, which is striking compared to any other study that perhaps has been published so far.
Well, how do you explain that?
The difference, I think, mainly is that this is diagnosed on the basis of echocardiography rather than a cardiac catheterization data.
And you think those data are softer?
I think, yes, there is an overinterpretation perhaps of the results, because when these studies in other papers published perhaps a few years ago by groups also from France but also from Asia, they've shown that when you pair the cardiac catheterization with the echo, then the incidence of portal pulmonary hypertension will go down to single digits, and even, you know, in some of them, less than 1%, which is perhaps what we have been seeing from a clinical perspective.
All right, then. So how do you decide when you are going to start vasodilator therapy? What tests are trustworthy?
Only the catheterization, the right heart catheterization, and the pulmonary artery pressure directly down with that.
Direct measurement of pulmonary artery pressure through right heart catheterization, a not uninvasive procedure, I must say. How do you select children for this?
So we can start first and foremostly by the oxygen saturation monitoring. We'll do a baseline echo, and from there we have to find highly selective criteria to be able to justify such an invasive procedure. I think it's a little bit, you know, like the discussion about hepatic venous pressure gradient as well. When you put pediatric patients under such invasive procedures, you have to have very strong supporting evidence to say that you will make something out of it, and also that there are tools there to change their management, not just record the finding, but also what are you going to do after the test.
Well, that's what
and
those,
that's very
those must be the vasodilators that I was referring to. Well, if any of these questions, any of these problems is going to be satisfactorily addressed, it's only going to be through studying substantial numbers of pediatric patients with portal hypertension and with pulmonary hypertension as a complication. And to do that, it seems to me that you have to create a registry to collect those patients and to enable them to be followed in a systematic manner. And wouldn't you know it, here is an article titled Considerations in the Development of the International Multicenter Pediatric Portal Hypertension Registry, with as first author, and we're all very proud of him, Tasos Grammatikopoulos. And I see that one is Ackerman is also among the authors. Tell us about this registry.
Yes, thank you, Alex. That's I think that's a great initiative, and obviously we're very proud to be part of this. It's an initiative that was started by Ben Schneider in Baylor, Texas. And it's also a some work that's been supported by an Espagan networking grant, and we're very grateful to Espagan for doing this. We wanted to answer some of these questions. The registry was built up, you know, just to answer two major clinical questions at the onset, which was the first variceal bleeding and the role of primary prophylaxis in children.
So was it easy to do? What were the challenges that you encountered?
Yeah, so easy was not. It was a very challenging work that was very time-consuming and very elaborate. And also, it took great efforts from a larger team, but mainly, you know, from the team in Baylor, and Ben Schneider obviously put a lot of his personal time for that. Main restrictions and limiting factors were obviously balancing the data requirement for each individual centers. There are more than 44 centers participating in the study. We have about now, I think, 700 participants. And obviously, we need to make sure that the data is all correct. We needed to make sure that all the paperwork, the approvals between centers and the study, the registry holding center, which was Baylor, was all in place, and that also, you know, the there was an element of retrospective data that also needed to be checked regularly between the corresponding centers.
It sounds laborious, let's put it that way, but are you ready to share any of the preliminary results?
No, we're not ready yet, but we will have some work, you know, presented in future meetings later this year, and we're looking forward to more and more data arising. These registries take a very long time, especially for pediatrics.
You're making excuses again. Well, folks listening at home or wherever you may be, don't change your channel. Get back to Juanes, get back to Tasos, and pressure them. Make them tell you what they're seeing. Otherwise, how are we to make any progress at all? But speaking of progress, so we've progressed to the end of our time for this podcast. And it's time to ask you both whether or not you can contribute to the Spotify Espagan podcast favorite songs playlist. Anything that particularly speaks to you both?
Yes, we've chosen a song by Nina Simone called Feeling Good.
Nina Simone, Feel Good. Well, I hope that you both feel good after putting me through this excruciating procedure. I certainly feel good about it. And thank you very much for having come to speak with us today.
It was a pleasure, Alex. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.